Until gay.
Hey, y'all. This is the Queer Archive, a queer and feminist Doctor Who podcast. I'm Brenna.
And I'm Caitlin.
And this week, we're talking about the fifth episode of Series 11, The Seringa Conundrum.
Let's talk about how much we love this cast and the Pating's perfect posterior. All right, pull to open. Our initial reactions, Brenna.
Pating butt. End of notes.
End of notes.
Episode over.
Here, here. Oh my gosh, we have a proper alien this season. It happened. I mean, we had one in the first episode, but
yeah,
here we are again. Stitch, come get your cousin. We see it. I love the Pating.
Chris Sanders is shaking. I love the Pating too. He's very cute. I love when they electrocute him with the stasers and he falls face forward. I strongly encourage everybody to go watch that scene immediately and just keep your eye on the little Pating and how he passes out face first. It's really cute. He's like,
literally everything the Pating does is iconic, honestly.
It's true. Every time he came on screen when we were rewatching, we would be like in the middle of a thought and then we'd be like,
I was telling Brenna, it's basically that diagram of your intelligence going down and the insanity of your comments going up the closer you get in the diagram. It's a cat, but for us watching this episode, it's watching the Pating. We just gets on screen.
His little butt's so cute when he disappears down the pipe, I die.
Also, shifting gears. In this house, we stan Mably.
Yes, we do. She's so great. Lois Chimimba is super cute, and I really like her performance as Mably.
She does a great job.
She does. Actually, like, basically everybody does a great job. Congrats to the actor who's playing Ronan. He plays that role so straight-faced with his shark eyes and never blinking, and he always moves, like, full stiff-bodied.
I'm really not convinced David Shields just isn't an android in real life.
Yeah. Speaking of congrats to actors and their choices, Suzanne Packer, you fucking powerhouse.
She really is.
I really wish the script gave her more. Women so rarely get to just, like, blow in with brisk competence, and that's, like, the thing that defines their character.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to see it here. She does a good job.
Yeah, I would have loved to see more from her as well. But, I mean, the cast was packed, so.
Yes.
I mean, I love how our pulled open is basically just an award ceremony thus far.
Everyone, good job. Good job.
Congrats to this performance. Truly inspiring acting. And then our next note is congrats to Astos on his eyebrows.
Yeah. He has great eyebrows. They're good.
It's true.
Congrats to him and his eyebrows.
It's a noteworthy
performance.
Sure. His eyebrows are really performing.
They're doing it.
This actor, side note, was in another film with Jodie, Adult Life Skills. It's devastating. Go watch it.
What an endorsement. I will rush right out.
It's true. And also, I think it deserves the warning. People deserve the warning, truly. I wasn't warned. From the poster and the trailer, it truly looks like a lighthearted, maybe rom-com.
But no, it's not.
Could not be farther from the truth. Speaking of Astos, I'm really also glad that they killed off a character in the beginning because, like I said, the cast was kind of bloated.
Yeah, this is more of that chibi classic. There's 8,000 side characters. They're all interesting.
This is just the beginning, y'all. Also, I'm glad it was one of the white guys.
Yeah.
Right? That being said, I am a fan of this cast. The only white men are either a nurse, pregnant, or a droid.
We give that 2
I'm okay with
up.
That. Yeah.
We rate that, yes.
If you gotta have them, I mean, okay. I mean, and then there's Graham.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've already resigned ourselves to that reality.
Yeah, he's on the team.
we'll enjoy him even.
Yeah, we'll talk more about his evolution later in this episode. It's fine. Is it? Anyways.
Okay, the rest of the pool to open is actually truly Deck 7 bullshit.
Okay, go for it.
So, I had a note about the doctor. I have several notes about the doctor, actually. poor doctor. Just got her TARDIS back and is already without her again.
Yeah.
I would be a stubborn mess, too.
Yeah.
So, I understand her behavior in the beginning. And then she pretty much immediately loses her Sonic for a while, too.
Yep.
I also love how offended Ryan is on her behalf.
And it's got nerve.
Very cute.
Pretty much just ignored you there, Doc. Yeah, I know.
So unhelpful, as per usual, Graham. I love a lot of the things about the Doctor that doesn't change. That we get to see for the first time in Jodie's incarnation, when she tells Eve, more like a volume, when she corrects Eve.
She comes back.
More like a volume than a chapter. The Doctor has got no chill.
Her smile, too, when she's like, it's more like a volume than a chapter.
Like I said, something's never changed. The girl is literally in pain every time she walks or turns, but decides it's fucking worth it to about face, walk back, and tell a pilot the truth.
Yeah.
And speaking of things that never change, when she's talking to Yaz and setting the bomb and everything, and she says, that's what I've been working on this whole time. Please don't be wrong. I'd be so embarrassed. Is totally echoing Capaldi's,
I hate being wrong in public. Everybody forget that happened.
Which I love. I love, I love. But then the Patine comes waddling back in like a drunk little toddler to prove the Doctor right. And the way the Patine drops the little snack
so at the cute. Side
of the bomb, like a real entree.
He does walk like a little two-year-old. And he's just
fucking
like,
drunk and just like drops the shit. Yeah. Another thought that I was thinking about on this rewatch was how important it is for them to actually have med tags.
Yeah. Like,
no wonder they need them, because intergalactic nurses would have to know so much shit.
Yeah.
It's hard enough to treat humans, let alone almost endless numbers of species.
Yeah.
I couldn't even imagine.
Madly's so she's like, nerves I need are 100% the fucking med tag. Yeah.
I don't know what your lifespan is. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, where do you come from?
What kind of breath? What oxygen? I don't know. Is it called oxygen?
Yeah, like, I think most sci-fi operates on the most sci-fi and our current search for additional like planets with that could sustain life. They always start with the base assumption that you would have to have oxygen, which I think like, is stupid.
Is it always called oxygen?
And human-centric, yeah. Well, yeah. For us, it would be.
What a human-centric question.
There are definitely forms of life that live and don't need oxygen, whatever.
Literally like. The Batang. Anyways. And
lives in space! Keep going.
So it doesn't need oxygen.
We're leaving it in!
Speaking of which, this episode is generally nerve-wracking.
It's very
tense. Across the board. The Batang breakdown in particular, and the events afterwards, honestly, are like when Boromir gets hit, three times with arrows to his chest, and still that orc stay coming for his head. I remember watching this episode the first time and being like, nah, though. Like, for real, how are they going to get out of this one? There's too many things.
There's a lot of things.
Okay, so like, Patang, fatally violent. Okay. Eats your ship until you have no more oxygen or heat. Okay. Super fast. Okay. Wait, toxic skin? What the fuck? You can't even touch this motherfucker?
Antimatter bomb.
That's one too many things. You can't touch him? No, I draw the fucking line.
There's literally three strikes.
The Patang breakdown is like a rundown of 2020 and then a good luck.
Yeah. Good luck, bitch.
I was just like so fucking stressed. And by the time they get to Yoss like announcing he's trying to bring a baby into this mess, I'm like, not right now. Read the room, Yoss. Read the room.
That's why he says sorry. He's like, sorry.
I know. But still, like, don't.
But don't? And why?
Anyways. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to see neuropiloting back again.
Yeah.
It's fucking dope.
It is cool.
We saw it first in Under the Flood, and we're like, hey.
Yeah. We've seen that before. Yeah.
I thought it was originally from this episode.
Yeah.
Just because it has so much more of a central role in the episode. And in Under the Flood, it's like they just happen to be flying with
He's their piloting the submarine with it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you're not flying. You're piloting the submarine. But I still stand it. It's still cool.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I think it's time to fire up our own neuropilot rig to get out of here and head for the High Council to talk about the Ray Holman and the sweet-ass aesthetics of this episode.
Let's do it. All right, we're up in the High Council of Gallifrey, the segment where we discuss folks in the power positions in the world of Who production. Who do we got?
Written by Chibi.
Of course.
I think that the scene where Ryan talks about his mom is not Chibi's finest writing, but I do think Tosin makes some really interesting choices.
He does.
And I especially think about when Yaz asks him who found her, and he, like, clenches his jaw and looks at her in such a way that it's like, ooh, poor baby.
He is holding on to not crying so hard.
And also, just a couple lines later, and this is why I say this is some pretty typical Chibnall work, I think. It's not his best, but that Ryan is trying to empathize with his dad when he's saying, it must have been hard for him to look at me and see my mom. Like, that was probably pretty tough. So I think this shows some of the glimmers of that stuff that Chibnall can, man, he can really knock it out of the park. Again, shout out to Broadchurch for being just a really devastating one season of television. There are other seasons. Season 2 is fine. I never watched 3. But he can really write. I can
feel Joy's anger in the background.
She's just simmering with rage.
Anytime it's brought up, she's like, I fucking hate that.
Sorry, Joy.
She's much more graceful than I can say.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, like, season 1 of Broadchurch is just, he can write those little intimate, cozy scenes that really just fucking break your heart. And you can see the glimmers of that here, but it just kind of gets lost in the 8,000 cast members or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, I do talk about Ryan's conversation with Yaz later on in The Heart of the TARDIS, of course.
It's not as good as Graham's scenes from the last episode, which is par for the course. But I will say, whole world's pivot on acts of imagination is a fucking line. That's right.
Bars. Like, that whole scene, and I would consider it like a speech of the Doctor.
Yeah.
I also talk about that in The Heart of TARDIS. So good.
Yeah.
So good.
This episode was directed by Jennifer Parrott. I'm going to guess Parrott. One of those. And she also directs Kerblam. I have no strong feelings on direction for this episode, except I love the composition and cinematography of hands when they are showing somebody neuropiloting.
Yeah.
I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, they did a good job.
Which is also partially due to, shout out to the DP, Simon Chapman. The lighting in this episode is beautiful. And he also does Kerblam, which I also think is some very nice lighting. So, congrats.
That's true. Yeah. I see it. And Bray Holmand, of course.
Eve's outfit is so fucking good. It is fire. It looks so good.
I love literally all the costumes and the set design, honestly, in this whole episode.
Yeah.
The use of texture and lighting, like you said, really stood out against the almost completely white interior spaceship. It looks like they were basically inside an AirPod case the whole time.
That would be Arwell Wynne-Jones, the production designer. He also did 13 Sonic and her TARDIS. Loves a shape, Arwell does.
Loves a shape.
Mm-hmm. He does.
Specifically vibrator shapes. But yeah, the ship looks like it was designed by Apple, but if their artist in residence was James Turrell. Am I wrong?
You're not
wrong.
Find
the lie.
No. Well, Arwell made a set that shapes or contains light, but I think it's time to turn the lights off in this segment.
Nice.
That's a James Turrell joke.
Nice.
Let's double move
nice.
On. Thank
nice
you.
Nice squared.
Let's move on to the Black Archive to talk about some casual transphobia and shitty bog standard ableism.
Ain't they always casual and standard?
Aren't they always?
All right, we're in the Black Archive, a segment where we talk about such dangerous and forbidden and powerful stuff that even the Doctor can't go there. Here we examine things like race, class, sexuality, gender, bodies, and all the good stuff. Let's go.
This episode is transphobic.
Indeed.
But
more.
It's the episode thinks it's progressive, which is one of the worst brands of transphobia, in my opinion. When first time we watched this episode, I remember when it finished, I was like, I liked that, but there's something that didn't taste good in there, and I don't know what it is yet. And I remember you were like, what? And I was like, I don't know. Just give me a minute. And then, like, literally, I think it was weeks later, I was, like, in the middle of something, or I woke up for the day, and it was like my brain just finished firing the message. Because I remember being in the middle of something else and going, oh, it treats gender like a stable, reproducible category, and that's transphobic. That's why I don't like it. And then I was just like, oh, well, That's upsetting.
Cool. Because I knew it was like trying to be progressive and wasn't successful.
Yeah.
But we were like trying to name it for a little bit and just moved on. And then we're like, got it.
Yeah. Okay. And I remember when I came back and I was like, it came to me. I thought this. You were like, yes, of course. And it was just like both of us went, duh. Oh. Yes.
Spoiler alert. This is what we send to A Crack in Time and Space. Yeah. Because obviously. Shitty. So we'll break it down later. But we have to talk about it in here because gross.
Super right? Gross.
Yeah, and the worst part is that they are actively patting themselves on the back for being
they think super they are so woke. Yeah.
And it's so funny because this episode actually does get shit from people who fucking just hate the
SJWs,
era, right? And they're like so offended by the idea of a man being pregnant. But again, spoiler alert, that's not spicy at all because men do get pregnant here now in real life.
That's not sci-fi.
You don't need sci-fi to be inserted for that to be possible.
Yeah.
So acting like that is a sci-fi topic is that's you're
outrageous.
You're denying that there's men who can't have babies. Yeah. Anyways. Moving on. Because there's more to talk about in this lovely black archive.
Continuing on the idea of this episode thinks it's progressive, but it's fucking not. I really like that the doctor apologizes to people.
Me too.
I like that when things happen that she's like, oh shit, that she actually says, I'm sorry to people. And also, I wonder how much of it is prepackaged in misogyny that she's a woman, so she's bound to apologize more. She's like, the only doctor out of any of the doctors who, when separated with her TARDIS, could be convinced to not, like, if this was any other doctor, they would have turned the whole ship around to go and get the TARDIS.
Right.
She is the only one. And again, I wonder how much of that, her being persuadable to hear when somebody says, you're being selfish and you're prioritizing your personal wants over the needs of everybody else on the ship. I wonder how much of that is because she's a woman.
Which is Astos talking to the doctor and convincing her, hey, you're compromising the safety of the rest of this crew.
Yeah.
And, like, in that exact interaction, it's actually a man talking to her and convincing her as such. It helps that he's actually a nurse. And in that role, he's not just a white dude trying to exercise his power over her necessarily.
Yeah. I would characterize his performance as gentle. He's playing that
totally
as
agree.
Soft.
I agree. Which is why I am okay with his character.
Yes.
Again, like, all the white dudes in this episode are either nurses, pregnant, or a droid.
Yeah, except for Graham.
Except for Graham. Graham is Graham. Graham is a muggle. But I agree. It's like this thing where you have to sit with it and enjoy the growth for the doctor as a character, but also sit with, we've never seen this before, and it took the doctor becoming a woman in this world for writers to write the doctor as someone who can do those things, which is shitty. And so at the end of the day, I just let myself enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I know what's going on.
Yeah. And I see that being connected to Astus's speech, his inspiring speech to Mably, where he's like, believe in yourself. I believe in you. So Mably needs a man to validate her skills, which is ridiculous because her skills are demonstrably good on her own. She is smart. She is empathetic. She's compassionate.
She's so good.
Yeah. So, but it is just part and parcel with the man is the one that speaks validation and speaks truth. And that's what inspires her to be okay with finishing out the run on her own. And that's
I believe in you. I always have. That line always cracks me up.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately the doctor is actually who gets Mably through everything. So really, we could have just done without Astos needing to validate her expertise at all.
Yeah.
He could have really just remained simply a nurse that was kind. And that would have been even more powerful because the doctor is the one that really motivates her. But there's something icky about the way that the story is constructed. Is like
it frames him as heroic for that.
Exactly.
Again, this just, it's an episode that thinks it's being progressive, and it's not. And this episode is written by a dude who thinks he's being so feminist. And it's like, you're really not.
Classic Doctor Who doing the feminism. Really it so rarely pulls it off.
Yeah. It's just, no girl, no.
But yeah, this episode is one of those that I'm like, I generally let a lot of it go until I start really critically engaging it. But there is a lot of the good stuff in this episode that that's what I choose to take away from it.
The pating butt.
The pating butt is top of the list. Yeah. Really motivates me in my day-to-day life.
His little butt is so cute.
Yeah.
The pating butt, his little drunk toddler walk, his little happy face after the bomb explodes inside of him. Again, oh, end of list, we're done.
The way his tummy little glows.
And he's like,
So satisfying. Yeah, but I think this episode in general is such a good example of how casual and mundane all of these things are. Like sexism, the ableism, the transphobia in this episode. Yeah. They're sneaky.
Yeah, they're
fucking
just
underlined in all of this shit.
They're baked in. That's right.
They're like unquestionable.
Yeah, the ableism one I think is the most. It's both the bog standard and also one of the most upsetting parts to me. I was about to say the most upsetting, but everything we've been talking about is upsetting, so I take it back. So let's talk a little bit about Eve Cicero and her condition. She has Pilate's heart, which sounds, we don't know a lot about Pilate's heart than it is a condition that you can get from neuropiloting too much, and that it causes surges of adrenaline around the heart, which is why she needs those adrenaline blockers, because the heart won't be able to handle it. But they frame, it's really weird, because they talk about Pilate's heart as like a, it's not really weird. It's ableism. So they frame the disease as a failure on Eve's part. Like it's a moral failure that she has Pilate's heart. And it sounds like they're saying it's her fault. It's Eve's fault that she has this disability, which is sort of like a hazard of the job. But she says, I'm the most decorated pilot in Kiva history. I cannot have Pilate's heart. And it just that the idea that she is somehow broken or an embarrassment or bad, like she is morally bad because she has this condition.
She's really
which she got for being a badass in battle and like protecting her people. That's how her brother describes her, right? He says she helped us fight against the Aeonians and she's the most decorated general in Kiba history, but it's this like huge failure on her part that she has a condition that she got through service, and that's just so shitty.
Yeah.
And really it's shitty.
Also just internalized capitalist logic as well.
Yeah.
Where your worth is tied to your productivity and how these two things intertwine all the fucking time. Ableism and capitalism are best buds, and they are constantly intertwined. So you treat your body as a machine, and if you can't keep going, and if your body fails you in any way, you're intrinsically worth less.
Yeah.
And I think those two things are kind of just like an internalized belief that she has that's just coming out as understandable talk.
Yeah.
Everyone's just like, oh yeah, I get why you would feel ashamed.
Why you're embarrassed.
And it's never challenged as a wrong ideation.
Even the doctor doesn't really check it to be like, hey man, that's like part of living and part of doing a job like this is you take a risk and it's not something you'd be embarrassed about.
And the contradictory logic of these ways of thinking and of these systems are that you, probably especially as a Black woman being that accomplished, have to work your ass off to get that recognition.
Yeah, you have to be twice as good to get half as far.
Yes, absolutely. And if you do so, you probably had to push your body further than its limits.
Yes.
I think of Beyonce immediately thinking of like what she had to push her body to get Homecoming accomplished is scary, right? Yes. And so this woman had to do such extra long flights, basically.
Yeah, the longest flight in Kiba history, he says.
In order to become recognized as who she is. And then as soon as your body fails because of that, then you are punished again. And it's just this endless cycle of us actually treating our bodies like machines.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's a super upsetting reading available here that Eve's ambition is what kills her.
Exactly.
She becomes the pilot, the general, and that's what ends up killing her in the long run. Mm-hmm. And that is shitty and sucks.
I know.
Sucks.
For how much, like, we stan her and how amazing of a character she is.
And, I mean, like, the thing that describes her, like I said at the beginning, is that sort of brisk competence where she just comes in and she's like, I can do this, this is my specialty, blah, blah, blah. And ultimately, because that's what we know about her, then we know that that's what killed her. And that sucks.
Mm-hmm. Don't you love it?
Shitty.
Like, I don't want to bash this, like, too hard. I feel like, because there's, like, in the end, like, I love her character and I love that she's the badass that she is.
Yeah.
And I think they do a really good job with her character in general.
I think if you could eliminate, like, the ableism out of it.
That's what I was trying to say. It's like, you could write this in a way that imagines her plot and her story moving forward without using ableism as the mechanism to do so.
Oh, yeah. But because that's how they use ableism as a shorthand for the conflict between her and her brother, it just ends up being kind of crummy. Even though this episode is fun. This is one of the episodes we rewatch the most.
It is.
But
it's part just like a solid, hopeful little space romp.
Yeah. But part of that is because it's fun, a lot of stuff gets
swept under the rug.
Yeah.
Because, again, this episode is showing just how casual this shit is. So much of our ableism is super casual. Hardly any of it is super overt.
Ableism is the hardest to unlearn because it is so baked into our cultural mores, especially in a late capitalist society. So I think you're on the money that it's really, really tough to flag and also really tough to try and undo.
Yeah. And if you're not being critical, it just happens literally on accident because you're not purposefully and intentionally looking for it, which is why Doctor Who should just have writers that have disabilities. Yes. They should have writers that are already walking through life with this lens and know how to look for these things. And then just, it wouldn't happen. Yeah.
Or
they would know how to look for it.
Bare minimum, the literal least, higher sensitivity readers.
I know, that is the bare minimum.
That is the literal least.
We would have to fight for that. But yeah, but just cut to the chase and hire these writers.
Yeah, disabled people of color exist.
Yeah.
They would gladly pay them. They will gladly read your scripts and tell you when you're being shitty. Anyways.
Amen.
What about Bechdel and DuVernay?
It totally passes both Bechdel and DuVernay.
This is what I'm saying, this episode. It passes Bechdel and DuVernay. It passes easily, actually. It was just like sail through, no qualifications.
It really did.
Yeah.
We have the general, we have Mabley, we have three talking to the doctor. Yaz does like hardly anything in this episode, but she's there.
Yeah.
And Ryan gets a lot of development.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing a really good job with these two tests in particular. And at the same time, you can do really well at these tests and not think critically.
That's right.
Yeah, about these certain things.
I was going to say, it's a good thing it passes Bechdel and DuVernay because woof to this black archive. Woof.
Well, I have a perfect antidote for that, though. We can head to the heart of the TARDIS for some good old-fashioned warm, fuzzy feels.
Oh, yeah. Okay. As long as there's nothing sad in there.
Trust me. It's all sweet. We can hear a word from our sponsor on the way.
Sounds good. This podcast is brought to you by the Rhesus One Birth Bud. Rhesus One provides expert care throughout the galaxy with doctors and medics who are trained in the finest medical schools in the seven systems. In these turbulent times, we need to know that our health needs are covered by competent, compassionate doctors, especially when it comes to bringing new life into the world, which is why we developed the Rhesus One Birth Bud. The Birth Bud marries all the training of our expert medical staff with all the benefits of 67th century technology. Programmed with coaching techniques ranging from gift-hand doulas all the way to human nurses, the Birth Bud supports a range of delivery styles, all with culturally sensitive programming to usher a new child safely into the arms of any new parent. With the Birth Bud, there's no need to call a midwife. Simply turn the Birth Bud on, select your preferences, and you'll have a bouncing bundle of joy in your hands in no time. Rhesus One Birth Bud. We deliver babies and hope for all. This is the Heart of the TARDIS, where we talk about feels and or morals of the episode.
Ryan and Yaz get a moment.
Yeah.
I love hearing more about Ryan in general. He's really embarrassed, like we were talking about, but he pushes through that.
Yeah.
And that's what I love to see, him letting himself talk it out little by little, and that's, like, what he's doing throughout the whole season.
Yeah. And you get that part of how you can mark his journey is calling Graham granddad and the fist bump.
Ugh.
I know, but that's part of what...
They could have used another marker. That's I'm saying.
But that's what Chibnall is using as his marker, which we're at the midway point of this season. And
I love that he doesn't...
Graham tries.
This is the thing, though.
And Ryan goes, no.
To me, that's a good boundary, not a result and a product of him not being vulnerable. I'm like, this dude, Ryan has every right to be weary and suspicious of Graham. This dude has to prove his love and dedication for Ryan.
Yeah.
Especially with Ryan's history with parental figures.
Yeah. It's also like a huge. I just
wish it was a different marker.
Yeah. It's a huge rehab of his character from Woman Who Fell to Earth. Because in Woman Who Fell to Earth, Graham fucking sucks. But in this.
There's a weird shift.
In this episode, you can see how different he is from the opening episode because every time somebody says something rude to him here, he's like, ah, well. Takes
it off. Yeah. Ryan's like, no, I'm not doing that.
And he rolls off his back and he's like, okay, that's fair. That's basically what his face is in the background.
It's true.
And so it's a pretty big shift for Graham. Too. And that's how part of where you can see Ryan's evolution, where he's kind of softening a little bit towards other people. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people, we've talked about this before, a lot of people feel like Tosin's performance is wooden, but I really feel like Tosin's performance, especially in the first half, is just really guarded. And you can gradually see him letting the guard down across the season, which is
with
good.
With safe people.
That's right.
I'm always an advocate for staying guarded with unsafe people. Yeah. So it's like, these people have to prove themselves to Ryan. And so loving getting to see him, like, acknowledging, oh, I can let it down when this is my fam.
Yeah. And Ryan, I mean, even without the particulars of his life that we learn in this episode, Ryan is a young man of color living in a racist world and dealing with the oppression and weight of racist systems that are literally actively trying to ground him down. Like, that is what systemic oppression does. And then in this episode, you learn his mother passed, which we knew, but under traumatic circumstances, and his dad left with his knowledge. Oof. Ryan knows that his dad left because he looked too much like his mom. So we learn the particulars.
Just to name a few things.
That's right. Which is why it makes a lot of sense that Ryan is really stay away and has a very large clearance around him. That makes a lot of sense because he already would have had to be hard by nature being a young black man.
And I love every moment of black boy joy that they give him in this season and in season 12.
Yeah.
I think written in his character is also a lot of that humor and that lightheartedness that I'm like, I'm so glad that that was present too.
Which is great because Tosin Cole's funny. And that plays to his strengths as an actor and as a human being.
Yes. I love him so much.
Yeah.
I just think he's doing good work in this episode.
He is.
On the other hand, it's Yaz drawing all of this processing out, right? Yeah. And I wish it just wasn't her always being the one to, you know, be that emotional support for literally everyone else, almost every episode, while never getting her own story told until the end of season 12. The end of her second season. That's when they finally start to dip into that.
That's when they give her some crumbs. Mm-hmm. Yaz can have some character development as a treat.
Exactly. So it's fine for her to have that skill, and I love to see it, but like the fact that it's never reciprocated for her, that's where I'm like, fuck that.
And also, I mean, again, not to drag down the heart of the TARDIS, but that is very part and parcel with a dude who thinks he's progressive writing a woman of color, and she ends up doing all the emotional processing work for everybody else.
How do you not see that? But on that note, at least Ryan was also playing a supportive role
for Yaz.
So more people than just the women of color were doing that role, which is great to see.
Yes, and I think that's sweet, his conversation with him when Yas is getting ready to give birth, and he says, you don't have to be perfect, you just have to be there.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Other than that exact Ryan contribution, I don't think I care about Yas's storyline at all.
Yeah, I don't
I don't have any strong feelings.
I think
feelings.
He's doing a good job, that actor whose name I've forgotten.
Sure.
I think he's good, but I don't care about it, and I think it is just there for progressive stage dressing, which I don't care about.
It was performative.
Here, absolutely. Have some fucking cookies. Get out of my face.
But in general, I come back to this episode with such, like, warm feelings. Even though when I first watched it, I was mad underwhelmed.
Yeah, I remember you being like, this episode's not very good.
I think it was just after, like, four really, really lovely episodes, in my opinion. Like, I loved Arachnids, so I was, like, ready for the next great episode, right? Mm. And this one just took such a different tonal shift for me that I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I just wasn't ready for it. And coming back to it, I was like, I super underestimated this episode and the role it's playing for the Doctor and in this whole season. It's not game-changing. It's not extraordinary. But over time, I've changed my opinion on it. And after watching the whole season, I realized this story actually does a really good job at capturing the hope that the Doctor embodies.
Yeah.
As a character, the Doctor in general. Particularly, I'm circling back to that speech that the Doctor makes with Madley.
I'm the Doctor. A doctor of medicine. Well, medicine, science, engineering, candy floss, Lego, philosophy, music, problems, people, hope. Mostly hope.
Oh, I'm struggling to see much hope here.
It doesn't just offer itself up. You have to use your imagination. Imagine the solution and work to make it a reality. Whole worlds pivot on acts of imagination.
I love that, especially for this moment in particular, because our world has done that before. Mm-hmm. And I love talking about it in those terms, because right now our world has another opportunity to pivot again. And let's be clear who's doing the imagination work. The Movement for Black Lives is doing just that. They have always been doing just that. And any politician, Mayor Garcetti, or any leader that says they are reimagining public safety, let's say, by continuing to give money to the police department so they can reform their practices, is just co-opting the call of what it really means to reimagine public mm-hmm. safety. Reform, when it comes to the police, is just, it ain't reimagining shit. But that's why activists and organizers are some of the best sci-fi writers, because they have been actively imagining new worlds all along.
Yeah. Speaking of which, if you'd like a rec, you should read Octavia's Brood. It's a short story collection written by activists. So very good. Yeah.
This is what I'm talking about. That's why, in particular, I think that line, whole world's pivot on acts of imagination, kind of goes down in my book as one of my favorite Doctor Who lines, period.
Yeah, it's a great line.
Speaking of other beautiful moments in this episode, the incantation at the end.
The incantation.
I feel like it's a step for Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I mark that one because there's just this graceful inclusion of spirituality and almost a magical element into the sci-fi environment mm-hmm. that Doctor Who so often owns. So This is something that has obviously been done so well so many times, just not something that is common for Doctor Who itself.
Well, and especially not in Capaldi's tenure, because right. 12 was, like, allergic to magic as a concept.
Yeah, they outright said that, for sure. Yeah. But in general, Doctor Who has definitely taken a more science or spirituality, and they don't mix. So it was refreshing here to see those two things coexisting and not canceling each other out.
Yeah.
And they did it beautifully.
Yeah. Speaking of which, second recommendation, if you'd like to see a series that mixes science and magic together, The Broken Earth Trilogy by N.K. Jemisin.
Yes!
So fucking good.
Purchase it right now.
Yes,
get it.
You absolutely should. It's so good.
My favorite sci-fi ever.
The audiobook narrator, if that's your bag, is real good. I love her reading.
I did all audiobooks mm-hmm. and bangers, every single one.
We can just start a Queer Archive book club with all the time we have.
Oh my gosh. It could be N.K. Jemisin exclusive.
It's true. She's doing so much good stuff. JK, the semester's starting, so I don't have any time.
I know. Whew. This will be a stretch.
Yeah.
We got it. It's time
yes.
to send something to a crack in time and space, and we already spoiled it for y'all.
Well, I was just going to say, do we send the transphobia or the ableism? It's really hard to pick just one.
I know. This is my least favorite game.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit more about the transphobia, since you were like, I'll unpack that later. I can't even with this.
I mean, it's redundant. We have been here before, but it's not so much the idea, again, of a man getting pregnant, which is what the haters of this era and this season think it's about. Because, again, that's totally possible now. It happens every day. But it's the idea that the binary, again, is so intrinsic to the universe that other worlds only abide by two genders.
Mm-hmm.
And
which isn't even true on this planet, but whatever.
It's not even true on this planet.
It's fine.
We just talked about this in the Slack. There are more intersex people than redheads or green-eyed people on this Earth.
Yeah.
On this one.
Yeah.
On this planet.
This current planet that you and I are standing on.
Yeah, we're like
this broke-ass 2020
two genders
world. Yeah.
And they align with sex.
Yeah.
Anyways, but this episode takes it a step further. They're like, we're not going to stop there. While pretending they're making a progressive point.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, the best. So what it thinks it's doing is poking fun at what our assumptions are about pregnancy and gender and et cetera.
Yeah.
So good. Encourage us to challenge our assumptions, categories, and understanding of what's possible. That's good. But again, to make this quote-unquote spicy take, they are implying the science of that world for the gift hands, not their belief or their social constructions. The biological truth about that world is that there are two genders and that they equal genitalia, and that they are so concrete that life itself, birth itself, depends on those categories being stable, because boys have boys and girls have girls.
Yeah.
And nothing else happens.
Yeah.
So it's just like, there's no room for trans people. There's no room for intersex people.
Yeah. And there's no room for non-binary people.
Yeah, there's no room for non-binary people.
Which is part of trans people, whatever.
Exactly. So it's like, come on. Again, we're a sci-fi show. What are we doing? This is the genre to imagine more than this.
And we've talked about this on the show before, that that is like specifically a Western preoccupation, that there are loads of cultures on the planet currently where their language has many, many words for gender, and that it is acceptable for people, not just acceptable, but that in some cultures it's like glorified and
two-spirit
people. Yeah, that you have an identity that straddles different categories. So this really is a Western philosophy just being born out, which you see in Yoss's when he goes, ugh, which is supposed to be poking fun at the idea of the binary, but ends up actually reifying the binary because of how it treats the binary in the Giftan culture. Anyways, yeah, that's shitty, and the ableism of this episode is, like we were saying in the Black Archive, it's just really shitty. So I think it's a double. I want to send both.
Okay. I mean, I'm not going to fight you. Just, like, give the scripts over to non-binary, trans people, people with disabilities, and they can imagine some good shit.
Again, you should hire those people. But even if you're not going to hire them to write, it will cost you some money. That is well worth it to have some sensitivity readers to stop you from getting back on your bullshit. So, bye, Ronimo, to both the transphobia and the ableism of this episode. Bitch. What about top three?
Top 500 moments. There are literally so many. Not even sorry.
I regret to inform you that I put a Graham moment in here, but it's first just one. So wow, fucking funny.
Out the gate.
When he says,
well, we've all hacked into our loved one's confidential records at one stage or another, haven't we?
Actually, Bradley Walsh does a great job in that whole scene where he's like, can I ask why? And he's like, oh, yeah, okay.
This episode really is a funny episode for Graham.
Yeah.
Like, they say begrudgingly.
I know.
I do love him and Tosin giving each other shit while Yoss is giving birth. And they bring up midwife.
Yeah, call the midwife,
I've seen every episode of Calls of the Midwife. Every episode?
Every episode?
Yeah, it's bang on, see, whilst you've been mucking around on YouTube, I've been learning useful life skills.
What? They didn't have that on Call the Midwife?
This, I think, marks the point where I started being like, oh, I like Graham, and that makes me really mad. But I do. I enjoy him from this point on. And like I said, it's because they started the rehab of his character. And this is about the point where he starts to get tolerable because he's nice. He lets things roll off his back. He's funny. Like when people are like, nah, bitch, to him, he's like, okay. And just walks away like, oh, all right. So I'm annoyed, but I do enjoy him.
Yeah. Speaking of Ryan, when Yoss tells him, put your hand here. Just go ahead. And then Ryan immediately just says, nah.
You're
all right.
Oh, that's so fucking funny. I love Ronan's delivery of, are you also experiencing comprehension deficiencies? That is
gold.
So fucking good. Yeah.
When I quote all the time, actually. Yeah. I also love Yaz being pleased as a peach when she gets 10 points from the doctor.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the points.
The beginning of the points and the beginning of me realizing that Yaz is a Slytherin.
What's
happening?
Y'all ready for these scores?
10 points for Yasmin Khan.
10!
I also love a quote from Mably. Right now, I'm imagining you sorting this all out.
It's good.
Well played, girl. I love that for you.
This is what I mean by this. This script is good. Like, there are some good little, like...
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, of course, a moment in here is 13 writing a love letter.
It's beautiful.
To antimatter.
Antimatter powering the movement of matter.
With some mostly accurate science.
To existence. I'm not the one to ask, so I'll take your word from it.
Space. I love it.
But it was just precious.
Yeah.
Fucking love her.
Yeah.
Also, in the heat of the moment, being asked how much time I've got, the doctor replies, literally
no time at all.
Dead.
I do love that he doesn't freak out about it. He's like, just give me some space. Yeah. Everyone in here is really rolling with the punches. Yeah.
Exactly. People prevail.
And I do actually really love the incantation. I think it's very beautiful and very sweet. There was a brief period of time where I thought I was going to get it around my TARDIS tattoo as well, but then I didn't because I didn't want to get that much script on my body, so I just got Be Kind instead.
Short and sweet, to the point. Yeah. Overall, I like the episode.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
And that's it for today. Next week, we will be talking about the sixth episode of Series 11, Demons of the Punjab. Here.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Queer Archive Pod.
We want to hear from you, your thoughts and feels on this episode.
And please rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice because it really does help other queerdos find us.
Until next time.
Be gay.
Reimagine.
Yeah. Tune in your speakers and please be my doctor, whoever. Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh.